welcome everybody to Health, Wealth, and Divine. My name is Juwanza. Thank you so much for tuning in today. It's a beautiful day outside, wherever you are. I mean, as long as they say, as long as you're on this side of the dirt, it's a good day. So just to be alive, you know, and just happy to be able to bring you another powerful show on entrepreneurship. For all of you following the show, you know that every Tuesday, every other Tuesday actually, we have the very fortunate pleasure of having as our special guest an entrepreneur extraordinaire, somebody who's been doing this type of work, when I say this type of work, entrepreneurship, for longer than many of you listeners have been alive. So anytime you have an opportunity to listen to somebody that's been doing something successful longer than you've been born, then I think it would behoove you to sit and listen, open your ears, and take a listen to hear what this individual has to say. My special guest is an author. He's written two awesome books. One is titled Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. That's the book that we'll be discussing this afternoon. And the other is Finding a Career for Life, another fabulous book that we will talk a bit about during the course of this interview, so that you know what that is all about, because there are a lot of people out there who are going back and forth between careers. And, you know, finding a career for life is going to help you to be able to determine whether you're in the career that's right for you, whether, you know, you made the right choice based on what statistics that you had, why did you make the choice that you made. And so we'll be getting into that a little bit during the course of the interview. But again, tonight we're going to be discussing entrepreneurial success, the road to the top, 105 business principles. We're going through the book chapter by chapter, principle by principle. And tonight's topic, the theme for tonight's show, is going to be starting a business. Starting a business. And this is in chapter 7. Let me tell you a little bit about my special guest if you're just tuning in for the first time. Professor Geiger is currently retired. He grew up on a Kansas farm and graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. And over this lifetime, he has started over 10 businesses, two of which predated his college graduation. And after his second retirement, he taught entrepreneurship and small business management. And in order to help people like you and me succeed in business, he wrote Entrepreneurial Success, 101 Business Principles. And this book has just been growing in principles ever since. And he's a lecturer, and again, he's a and professor. Before we get into the book, just again, we're starting with chapter 7, starting a business. Is there a particular reason why that starting chapter 7, someone might ask, starting a business, why wasn't that the first chapter? You know, any particular reason why the sequence of that is starting a business? I mean, it's kind of a rhetorical question, because there are certain other things that we discussed in the previous chapters that people definitely need to know before they actually venture in to opening a business and starting a business. But just to get your take on that.
Well, the reason I put it where I did is I tried to follow the way businesses actually work. And so the first chapter was on principles for business and life, which are just some basic principles that will help you regardless of whether you're starting a business or not. And then the second was finding a business opportunity, which you need to do before you can do most anything else. The third was a business plan. I contend that first you have to have the opportunity in mind, and then you do a business plan. And there's two parts of that. The second part is a financial statement, learning how to understand financial statements, and then buying a business if you wanted to do it that way. The legal ramifications is number 6, and that takes us to starting a business, so that by that time you have some tools. If you just started off, boom, with starting a business, one of the things you're going to do is probably fail, because you're not going to do it right. And until you start a business, you can't lose money at it. But once you start it, you better have some ideas of what you're doing, Otherwise, you're liable to go broke. And most businesses are started by the founder, their friends, and that they're the financiers. And the first is the founder. So if you get people to help you finance your business and it goes under, it probably will be an inconvenience for them, but it's certainly not going to be a disaster. But for yourself, it very likely will be a disaster. So I wanted to teach people some of the basic skills you need before you start jumping off into the business. Because once you start in that and you start spending money, just remember it's your money. And it's real easy to run out of money if you don't have the foundation beforehand. And so that's why it's, frankly, Chapter 7 instead of Chapter 1.
You know, Professor, you've cited in the past shows statistics that show the amount or the percentage of businesses that fail within the first year. Can you talk about that for a moment, just simply because, people need to know that there are a very large number of people that just aren't doing it the right way. I mean, you know, if you fail within the first year, something's going wrong. You know, there was
that's true.
Planning or something. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. About half of all the businesses that are started fail in the first year. And the definition of a failed business is you run out of money and you can't pay your bills. Now, some people have the intelligence to see that if they continue, that's what's going to happen, and so they shut it down before they run completely out. Although I've seen a lot of folks who ran completely out of money, and when they shut down, they ended up owing, and it's a disaster. So if you know what you're doing and you do a business plan, you do a cash flow forecast, and you're really, really harsh and honest about it, you will figure out that perhaps you don't have enough money and when you're going to run out of money. And so you don't start until you solve those problems. The time to solve the problems is before you start draining your bank account. So find the problems on paper, and you're still going to miss some. I mean, it invariably happens, and almost regardless of how conservative you are, you'll very likely spend more money than you thought. And so what I tell people is you do a cash flow forecast, and then you say, okay, I'm going to spend $100,000. So the minimum you want to start with is $130,000, and $150,000 is better. You can always, if you have too much money, nothing bad happens. It's when you need another $5,000 that you don't have and you can't make payroll that things go upside down in a big hurry. So historically, it's been 50%. Now, a lot of people, you'll see a lot of textbooks that say it's way less than that. But you need to define what a business is. And a lot of those textbooks, they're thinking in terms of what most of us would call pretty big businesses. The average business in this country, every year, the IRS says that there are about 600,000 businesses started. And the average probably has two or three employees. So they're small. And an awful lot of them are not counted. So the way that professors in college and book writers count them, if you start a business with one person, you started a business. And if 6 months later you're having trouble making payments for your house or your apartment and you decide to close it, then that's a business that started and closed and failed. Mm-hmm. So it's a very big number, and the reason is there was no planning. I can't tell you how many people have come to me and said they wanted to start a business, they were all ready, and you started to ask them some questions as, well, if you want me to help, let me see your cash flow forecast, then the answer is, what's that? And you want to see the business plan, and the business plan is a single page. Well, that's sad, but what's going to happen is you're going to go upside down unless you're awful lucky. I mean, when I started my first one, I thought I was, the first one, I didn't make any provisions at all because it was a pretty simple business. And so I raised enough money to get it started, and then I was lucky and kept it going. By the time I got to the third one, I'd figured out that I needed to do some planning. But the amount of planning I did on that and what I would do today are two very, very different things. And what I found out when I first started to do a really real organized plan, a real cash flow forecast, I was running a business and we were making money, but not very much. I mean, it was marginal. We'd make a profit and then I'd sunk that in and try to grow it. When I first started to do a real cash flow forecast, I tripled our profits in 1 year. And frankly, I should have done today. I would do better than that because I just know so much more on how to plan. And that's the big problem. The vast majority of businesses that are started, small businesses, there is no planning. Or if there is any, it's very minimal. Perhaps they'll go to Microsoft and look on the what they have there, and they have a very, very minimal cash flow forecast. And if you do that and you don't go broke, frankly, you're just lucky because that won't help you much.
Well, have you found that at the universities that they teach or not? Use certain business models that they're sharing with the students. And the reason I ask that is this. I had a friend of mine once who worked for an import-export company that was owned, the owners were, I believe they were Japanese. Mm-hmm. And he was sharing with me that their whole way of doing business was totally different than the way business was done in the U.S. Of course, there were some things that were, just normal business practices, but I guess their whole business model, and I wish I could remember what it was, but it was totally different than the way business was being done in the U.S. Have you found that when people are teaching or the professors are teaching, do they actually use different business models? And if they do, are those models just normally business models from, say, the U.S. and not other business models from around the world?
Well, the business models, first of all, I have used or reviewed 10 or 12 textbooks for entrepreneurship. And one of the textbooks was written by two people, both of whom had started a business. All of the others were written by people who had never even worked for a business, much less started one. Mm-hmm. They were people who went to grade school and high school, then on to college and got their bachelor's and master's and PhDs, and then went to work teaching in a college. And that's repeated over and over again. In the vast majority of colleges, the business professors in the business school of business, that there will not be a single one who has ever worked in private enterprise. And that's very, very common. At VCU, I went through every single professor several years ago. I found two that had actually worked for private enterprise. One was teaching insurance, and the other was teaching real estate. Every single other one had never, ever worked for a company started a business, and yet they were teaching entrepreneurship, or they were teaching some other part of business. The only college, and I hate to bring this up and sing the praises of one particular college, but the only one I know of that has a sizable business department is Liberty University. And virtually all of their employees, all of their professors, have worked in private industry for years before they ever started to teach. And they started to teach very often when they retired. And that's the only one. Hillsdale College has a relatively small business department, and their professors have actually had real live experience. But you broke your leg, so you've got a broken leg and you got a bone sticking out of it. Who do you want to set that leg? Somebody who has spent years and years in the operating room, or somebody who's spent years and years looking at books and studying it? Nobody would suggest the latter. But for some reason in colleges, that's common.
That's interesting, you know, because it sounds like a lot of credence is put on letters, you know, the amount of degrees that you have, and if you have, they obviously are feeling that if when hiring these professors that don't have any business experience, that they're substituting education for experience.
Right. That's precisely right. Now, you'll find some of them who have been consultants. But being a consultant and actually running a business are two very, very, very different things. With a consultant, they come in and tell you what they think you should do in order to make it. But it's not their money. If what they say is wrong, so, well, we'll try something else next time. That's an attitude that is fine for big business that have hundreds of millions of dollars in the bank and do billions of dollars worth of cash flow. But that doesn't work so well for the little guy.
Well, everybody, my special guest is Professor Joseph T. Geiger. We're going through the book Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. And tonight we're going to be starting off the conversation, well, we've already started the conversation, but we'll be starting off the chapters with, again, starting with chapter 7 tonight, principle number 53, which is successful businesses must be customer-driven. Successful businesses must be customer-driven. Professor?
Well, basically what I mean by that is if you don't satisfy your customers, you aren't going to last. And it doesn't make any difference, frankly, whether you're building billion-dollar aircraft carriers for the U.S. government, the Navy, or you're mowing lawns for your neighbor. If the customer isn't happy, they're going to find somebody who will make them happy. So you better understand that, because that's the truth. And so the number one thing that any business needs to do is make their customers happy. You satisfy their needs and their wants. And if you don't satisfy their needs and wants, you aren't going to live. You're going to go under, because somebody else. That's all well and good if you're in a dictatorial society. So if you have a communist or a dictatorial government and they allow you to be the only one who does something, well, then people, if they want it, have to buy from you. There was an entrepreneur in America who, for some reason, I guess he spoke Russian, and right after after the First World War and before the Second World War, he went to Russia, and he knew the oligarchs who were running the place, and he asked if he could have the concession to sell pencils, wooden pencils, And they said, well, don't you want something else? He said, no, no. If I can be the only guy who can sell pencils, I'll be happy. And he made millions and millions and millions of dollars. Because in Russia at the time, if you wanted a pencil, you had to buy the pencil from Arm & Hammer. There was nobody else allowed to sell pencils. Well, that's fine in that kind of society. But in a free society, in a capitalistic society, there's a lot of people who can sell pencils. So they're going to drive the cost of the pencil down, and they're going to make better pencils. And it doesn't make any difference how good a pencil you make. They're going to try to make better pencils because that's how they sell. So you have to keep your customer happy. And that should be your singular purpose. Everything you do should be, is this going to keep my customer happy? When I was in the airplane business in California, I started in Southern California, and then I opened this place in Northern California for the little manufacturer that I was representing. And then I opened another one in Seattle, Washington. And we ended up pretty quickly, within about 3 or 4 years, being the first, second, and third largest dealership for that airplane in the world. And people said, boy, you must be really selling them cheap. Frankly, I wasn't. I got more for the airplanes than virtually anybody else. I wouldn't discount. However, when somebody came in, and if something was broken on the airplane, let's say a radio went south, it didn't work, I would walk out to a brand new airplane that was for sale, pull a radio out of it, and give it to him. And then we'd send the one he had to get fixed. And when he came back, we would reswap. But the radios would slide into a little tray, and they would plug in the back. So you just unplug it, slide it out, put the other one in, and there you go. You're off. Goodbye. And people would say, well, don't you want me to sign something? Or, no, I don't. I want you to tell all your friends to come and buy an airplane from me. And that's what they did. So we had a policy that I gave people brand new airplanes to go on trips when theirs broke and we couldn't fix it that quickly. And here's a brand new airplane, has 8 hours on it, and you want to go on a 6-hour business trip. And so when you bring the airplane back, it's going to have 14 hours on it. And pretty soon, if you do that a little bit, people are going to say, this isn't the new airplane. So I try to keep it at a minimum, but I did it anyway. And that's how we, the airplane company had about, 25 or 30 dealers. And my three dealerships sold a third of their manufacture, for worldwide production. And we did it year after year. And that's how we did it. And people would say, well, I had people come in and say, well, I found somebody in Kansas who will sell it to me for less. I said, yeah, that's probably true. And if something goes wrong, you need to call the guy in Kansas. And they'd say, well, you can't do that. Watch me. You bet I can do that. But if you buy it from me, and something goes wrong, I'll do whatever it takes to get you back up in the air. And it was, after a while, it was pretty easy because I could open my dealership or my sales book and say, here are five people, pick them. The last five airplanes or pick five airplanes owners from any place you want in this. And I'll give you their phone numbers and you call them and see. And I sold a lot of airplanes that way. And the difference, I mean, these were $100,000 airplanes, and people could often buy them for $10,000 or $15,000 less, yet they would pay $10,000 or $15,000 more to me. And it wasn't just because I was cute. It was because the reason people buy the airplane is because they want it to work when they need it. And we saw to it that it would work.
You mentioned that you didn't, I'm sorry, Professor.
Go ahead.
I didn't want to cut you off. Go ahead.
No.
I was going to say, you mentioned that you didn't discount. Was that as a practice, just we don't discount if somebody came to you and said, hey, listen, you know, I like this airplane. You know, I really like it. But, you know, I was wondering if you could, you know, kind of cut me a deal. Maybe we can, you know, work something out. I mean, was it just a practice?
I had one time a salesman showed up. He went out into Southern California out in the desert, and he came back with a paper bag full of money. And we had an airplane that we had a price on it, and he had discounted it 10%. But he had about, I don't know, it was probably an $80,000 airplane. So he had $35,000 in cash. I told him to take it back. And he said, don't you want to see it? I said, no, I don't. The price is $80,000, and it's not $79,500. It's $80,000.
And he only had $35,000, though?
And they had a deposit of half in cash.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no. And as soon as we delivered it, we got the other half. And in cash. So we didn't even have to book it if we didn't want to, you know, pay tax or something like that. Well, the answer is no.
Right.
And that salesman just shook his head and said, you're kidding. I said, no, I'm not kidding. I told you what the price was. And guess what? The guy bought the airplane, and he paid full price. So, and I think I was about the only one in the, at least in the U.S., who was doing that. And most of the others, if they made 10, the airplanes were usually, you could, if you sold them for full price, you made 20%. And out of which you had, you know, you had to pay your salesman, you had to pay lots of stuff. So it wasn't like you sold a $100,000 airplane and you pocketed $20,000 and you and your wife went on a vacation. Not so much.
Right.
That's how we did it. And I think, again, I was about the only one who did that. And I got all the time, I got people who said they had they could buy it for less. And I had people who did buy it for less. And then when they needed service, they came, and I said, sure, I'll work on it when we get to it. But if you'd have bought it from me, we would stop doing whatever we're doing, and we would fix it now. And if it meant that we had to take a prop off of a new airplane and put it on yours, we'd do that. If it meant we had to give you a brand new radio until we got that one fixed, we'd do that too. So...
Professor, do you adhere to the principle that if you pay less, you're going to get less? I mean, because sometimes
no,
I think in the minds
I don't think so. I had my trainer in this. I worked for a guy for a couple of years who we sold yachts. And Mr. Ashby told me over and over again that a yacht is not a tool. It's not an investment. It's a toy. And it's a very expensive toy. And the one thing that people want who can buy a very expensive toy is they had limited time to use it. And if it broke when they wanted to go use it, they were very upset. So you pay full price and you get full service. And when somebody has a problem, you stop whatever you're doing and you fix it now.
Okay.
And you damn the cost. Don't care what the cost is. There's none of this business of you call the factory and to see if this is covered in warranty. Not a chance. You fix it. You send the guy on the way. And afterwards, you try to collect the warranty. If you can, whoopee for you. And if you can't, you have a happy customer.
Mm-hmm.
How many times, if you bought new stuff, that you've taken it back and say the widget broke on this, is it covered in warranty? Well, my attitude was, I don't care whether it's covered in warranty. We're going to fix it now. We're going to stop whatever we're doing on everybody else's airplane, and we're going to fix it right now and send you on the way, and it's not going to cost you one penny. So, and there was a bunch of stuff that I did not get warranty on, but, of course, I got full price to start with. So if it cost me $1,500 to fix something and I made $20,000 instead of $5,000 to start with, well, I was way ahead. And that's what everybody else would do, is they would sell it to close the sale, and then when warranty needed to be done, then they'd find out whether it was covered, and they'd get it covered before they started anything. We didn't do that.
You know, as you're speaking, I just thought about something. That's real customer service. You know, a lot of times when people think of customer service, they think of just, oh, being polite, you know, being polite, saying please and thank you, and, you know, greeting the customer with a smile when they walk through the door. That's part of it. But
yeah,
that was real customer service, stopping what you're doing, something when somebody's got a problem. That's real customer service.
Right. Yep, it sure is. And I have, we could do all kinds of things, and my competitors thought I was crazy in the head. But if they looked at my sales book, I was making way more money than they were because we just did not discount. But when it came time to service, didn't make any difference what it was. You fix it right now, and you worried about getting paid later. But my view was we got paid up front.
Right.
We didn't have to worry about later when we sold the airplane and we delivered it. We already were paid for a whole lot of service.
Yeah. So you owed the customer pretty much.
Right.
Okay, we owe you.
That was exactly my view. You hit it right on the head. I owed the customer because he'd already paid for all that service.
Everybody, you're getting this from somebody that's got over 50 years experience as an entrepreneur. We're going through his book chapter by chapter, principle by principle. The name of the book is Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top 105 Business Principles. So my special guest today is Professor Joseph T. Geiger. And now we're moving on to principle number 54. A policy and procedures manual will prevent many problems. A policy and procedures manual will prevent many problems. I think, Professor, for a lot of people that just start businesses, that's probably something that's overlooked by far too many people.
Yeah.
Matter of fact,
yep.
I dare say that of the percentage of businesses that fail within the first year, if they did a poll, they would find that most of them probably didn't even have a policy and procedures manual.
No. I mean, that's when you're starting a business, you're busy. And that's one that not almost always slips through the cracks, and they're a headache to write. They are a legal document, so you really need to have attorneys write them. And what I would suggest to anybody who thinks that they someday would like to work for have their own business is whoever you're working for now, if they have a policy and the procedures manual and they haven't already given you one to read, tell them you'd like to have one to read.
Mm-hmm.
And then you keep it. And what you'll find I threw them all out since I'm kind of at my age, I'm not going to start another business. But they're virtually all the same. And because they're all boilerplate. And what happens is you go pay an attorney $5,000 or more to write one, and basically what the attorney does is he goes to his legal word processor and types in policy and procedures manual. One hops up, and they ask for what's the name of the new business and what's its address, and he puts that in and he hits print. and sends it to you and says, where's my $5,000? And it probably takes him virtually no time at all, because he delegates it to his secretary or to a legal aide, and the total cost on it is $25, and that's what they pay the legal aide per hour. So it's easy to have one yourself. And once you have it, then you got to use it. And there's a specific way you use the policy and procedures manual. When you hire somebody, when Jim or Jane comes in to take a job, if you think that, yeah, we're going to give them a job, and you decide to do that, you give them a policies and procedures manual. Actually, you give them two. And you sit them down, and you say, read it. And I want you to initial every single page. And we're going to pay you to read it. Otherwise, it won't get done. So they read it, and they initial every page, and they give you the book back that's been initialed, and you give them another one to take home. And then when problems happen, which hopefully they won't, but they will in time. There'll be, you know, people problems are where the problems start. They go home and they say, well, you didn't do this and so. You say, well, what's the policies and procedures manual? You wouldn't let me go on vacation because I didn't give you a 3 weeks notice. Well, what's the policies and procedures manual say? Oh, it says you have to give a 3 weeks notice before you can go. And so you say, well, that's what it says. That's what we do. You read it. I have your book. It is initialed. Every single page is initialed. And we paid you to read the book. So
now, when you say we paid you to read a book, now, of course, I know what you mean, but there may be people who might not know exactly what you mean when you say that.
Well, let's say Juanza comes to work for me, and we settle on $20 an hour for whatever your job is, and it took you 5 hours to read the book. We're going to pay you $100, and that's in your first check. Will be the 5 hours we paid you. And if you're a monthly, and we're going to pay you $8,000 a month, the first day you sit in an office, you don't do your job, you don't do anything, you read the manual, and you sign it, and we pay you for that time.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we do that is because if you've done that, and if it's signed, and when problems come up, you're gonna have a hard time suing us. And because I spent 22 years in California, in business in California, I understand about lawsuits. And so I wanted my purpose was to prevent lawsuits, and this is a great lawsuit preventer. It will prevent the vast majority of lawsuits that people bring, your employees bring. Now, obviously, when they read it and they get one themselves, it means you have to follow the same policies and procedures. Mm-hmm. It's not just for them. It's for both of you. So you have to follow it. And if you think that you're not going to follow it, well, then you darn well deserve to be sued, in my view. Yeah.
Now, let me ask you this. When it comes to policies and procedures, they may change. I mean, or
right.
And well, let's say, for example, you get a new somebody buys the company, but they keep on, they allow the employees to stay. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they may have some new ideas or whatever. Unless they create a new policies and procedures manual, then it's assumed that everything in the old manual stays true. Or is that how it
works? Pretty much. And at least in California, if one of your employees sued you on that basis, they're going to win. So if you change it, and you don't have to have some new person come in, if you just decide that you're going to change your policies and procedures manual, you print out however many copies of the change that you need, and you give it to all their your employees, and you give it to them, you knock off work early on Friday, and you say, you guys can all go home as soon as you read and sign this sucker. And each of you is getting two copies. And so that signed addendum goes in their employee file, right along with the policies and procedures book that's already in there that they have signed. And it's one of those things that's a pain in the butt. You got to keep up, but you better keep it up. At least in California, you better.
So if somebody says, okay, an employer says, you know, instead of an hour lunch, you know, I'm cutting that back to, you know, a half hour lunch and, you know, two breaks, you know, two 15-minute breaks
yeah.
on the day, you know.
Right.
That better be in writing, correct? Because,
correct.
Because you can't hold the employee accountable if they come back, say, for an hour and you didn't, you know, put it in writing, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they shouldn't. I mean, if your previous position was they got an hour lunch and you change it to half an hour and they don't come back, whose fault is that? It's not theirs. It's yours. So people for some idiot reason want to not own up to their own problems. Well, when you're running a business, you better.
Yeah, because, you know, what's interesting about it, integrity works both ways, too. For example,
Absolutely.
If you have employees that you can have lead us into the next principle, if you want employees that have integrity, then you better have some yourself if you're running the company.
Absolutely.
Principle number 55, if you hire people with great abilities, you will build a company of giants. If
right.
you hire a company with giant abilities, you will create a company of giants, Professor.
Yep. Well, that's part of hiring, a philosophy of hiring. I always wanted to hire whoever I hired. I wanted them to be better at their job than I was. And in big companies and government, very often the boss does just the opposite, particularly if it's a weak boss. They are afraid to hire people with more ability than they have because what they think is that person is going to take their job and become the boss and the current guy is going to lose his job. Well, they don't understand how these things work. So let's say I own a company, you work for me, you run the manufacturing, or you run shipping, and you got four people who are shippers, and they never, ever miss a beat. Now, I never have to go out there, because I know when I give something to Juwanza to get shipped, it's, by God, going to get shipped now. So I don't even have to go out there. Who do I congratulate at the end of the year? John, Jerry, Smith, and Mary, who work out there, or do I thank Juwanza? I don't hardly even know John, Jerry, and Martha.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know them to say hi, and I probably know where they work, but what kind of job they do, I don't have a clue. They must be doing a pretty good job because it gets done. But who gets the accolades? Do they get the accolades? The ones who are actually doing the job, or do you? You get the accolades. So now maybe you couldn't put a widget in a box and type out the label and get it sent if your life depended on it, but your three workers can and do. So who gets the accolades? You get the accolades. Do I want to get rid of you because those three are doing a good job? Frankly, I don't know whether they're doing a good job or not. I know it gets shipped, but I don't know who's good and who isn't. All I know is Juwanza's department works like a clock. And how do you keep it working like a clock? Keep Jwanza running it. That's how.
Professor, I know we've got about 15 minutes left. I wanted you to, did you want to add something else to your statement?
No, that pretty well covers it. So you hire the very, very best people you can hire, and you tell them to do the same, and then you reward those who do good. And usually if they're doing a really good job, the big boss on top hardly even knows they exist, but they know you exist because the shipping department has no problems.
You said reward those that are doing a good job. What are your thoughts on monetary incentives? There are some people, and in some economies, you know, you're lucky to have a job. You know what I mean? The economy might be so bad, it's like you can't be worrying about a bonus. You're happy to get a paycheck, you know. But just in terms of monetary bonuses and incentives, your thoughts on those?
Well, monetary incentives are fine, but the personal incentive that you go thank somebody is really the best. And that's particularly the people who really are motivated by monetary incentives are usually the ones near the top. The workers are a whole lot more motivated by other things. People are motivated by really three things. They're motivated by money. They're motivated by accolades, and they're motivated by their peers. So the best there's a company called I'll think about it. Lincoln Electric, and Lincoln Electric had the best plan ever. And basically, they were a manufacturer of welders and all kinds of stuff. And for years and years, they were the number one in their industry. They never, ever had labor problems, and they sold their products for less, and they made lots of money. And the reason they sold them for less, according to Lincoln Electric, was because of their manufacturing people. And here's why. They had a program that if you were out on a line and you were helping to put together a welder, and you figured out a better way of making that welder that would save the company a lot, what you did is you put a note in a suggestion box, signed, and you got somebody else to co-sign it, so that everybody knew who did it. And then let's say that thing saved the company $1 million. What happened is, for the first 3 years, you got $333,000 of that million every year for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And then you didn't. For 2 years, your helpers who were in, well, they wouldn't necessarily be helpers, your peers who were on that particular job of putting together the welder, let's say there were three of them, and each of them got $10,000 a year for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And the last $333,000 was divided amongst everybody in the shop, in the whole place, all the workers. Management didn't get a cent because it's up to management to make these changes, but they didn't. You did. You came up with the idea.
Right.
So everybody got money. So, and then what happened is immediately your name was put up on a suggestion board that you came up with this idea. And it meant that everybody in the whole shop got $100 a year. And your buddies that you worked with, they got $10,000 a year, or actually $10,300. And or $10,100, and you got $300,000. Now, let's say your suggestion puts you out of business. you figured out a way that they didn't need you anymore. You think they fired you? Not a chance. You still got your $300,000 a year, whether you were working or not. But if you were working, you got your regular salary plus that. Well, this all happened. It started during the Depression in 1933 or 4. They had people in the depths of the Depression who were making over $100,000 a year when the average salary was less than $1,000.
Mm.
Or their average salary maybe was $10,000. They had lots of people who were making $100,000 a year, 10 times what the going wage was, because they came up with a good idea. And why were they so connected? Well, one, they got a financial incentive. What do you think their buddies were who worked with them, who were getting $10,000 a year? They thought, you were great.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, hey, Juanza, you have any more good ideas? And by the way, we're having a picnic next week. Could you bring your wife and kids over to it? I want to show you off.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the people who were just walking around who were each getting, $100 a month? They were saying, hey, Juanza, you got any more ideas? You know, this $100 is great, but yeah, I could spend another $100 if you got another good idea. So you were being praised. You were getting lots of money, and the company thought you were great. If you got in the let's say you were in battle on the Army, and you got a Medal of Honor. 3 years later, you had a choice. You could get either a Medal of Honor or you could get $1 million. 30 years later, what do you think would be most remembered? The Medal of Honor or the $1 million?
Remembered?
Probably
the medal.
You got it. How much did it cost the government to give you a Medal of Honor? $15? I don't know how much. But boy, are you somebody really special.
Mm-hmm.
So their incentive was psychological, financial is the second one, and that's the way to keep people happy. But the one that really works the best is the after you know the 3 years was out, and the old people who were there who'd been at that company for years and years would still be coming up to you and say, hey, take a newbie up. Meet Juanza here. He's the one who came up with that idea. And, hey, I made $100,000 a year for 3 years. You made $300,000 a year for 3 years. But I made $100,000 for 2 years because of Juanza's idea. You want to meet a really great guy? There's your great guy, Juanza.
Mm-hmm.
And so psychologically is how people are rewarded, and that's the one that makes the best. I'll tell you another story that actually I did. I needed a new janitor for my boat making or manufacturing plant, and I had a lady show up with her son. She was trying to find her son a job. And Billy was a really nice kid, but he had Down syndrome. Wasn't terribly severe, but he nevertheless had Down syndrome, and he just couldn't do a lot of things. And so she wanted to find a job for a janitor she thought he could do. Well, so I hired him. And about a month after he got there, he came to me one day, and he never looked at you. He always looked down. The poor kid had just been the shit beaten out of him all his life. Everybody he ever met told him he was stupid. And frankly, he wasn't very bright, but he was a great worker. And he came to me and wanted a new broom. So instead of my going to buy him a broom, I took him to Costco. I said, you pick out anything you want. you're in charge. You're in charge of the janitor division, department, for our whole business here. You're the boss, so you get whatever you need. Well, by the time I got back and he had picked out a broom and a few other things, he looked you straight in the eye. He was proud of what he did, and he was really good at it. He was the best damn janitor I ever had. And when he left and he got a job, he got an offer from a school district to be a janitor for the head janitor at a larger school, and they could pay him way more than I could. And he came to me and he said, "I got this job. What should I do?" And I said, "Take it, for God's sakes, take it. You know, they're paying you twice." He said, "Yeah, but you helped." I said, "Billy, you'll do just fine." And it almost brings tears to my eyes, because there are very, very few opportunities that one has that you can make a difference in somebody's life that's a real difference. I made a big difference in Billy's life. And he was the best employee I ever had. Just, he came in early. His job was not picking up the parking lot, but he did it. I mean, he made sure that every light bulb in the whole place worked. He was terrific. And he had Down syndrome. But all of a sudden, somebody gave him authority. It didn't make any difference that he was in charge of the janitorial department. There was one person in the janitorial department, that was Billy. But he was the boss. And terrific. Really worked.
I've seen those type of people before. I've actually worked around them, worked in places where you might have seen somebody with Down syndrome or some other condition. And you're right. You're absolutely right. I've seen the Billies of the world, you know, in action. You know, they do take pride, extreme pride in what it is that they do. And
well, nobody
really.
Yeah, the problem is with most of them is that people have treated them like dirt. And if you treat them like they have authority, that you not only you tell them you did a good job, but you're in charge. Oh, wow. Because they've never been in charge of washing the dishes. You know, they've never been in charge of emptying trash cans. They've been treated terrible, and if you treat them right, and that's true of almost everybody. Now, a lot of people have ability and pride. Recognize it.
You know, that's interesting, because he was a giant. You know, he was a
giant.
He was, you know, boy, he sounds like Billy was a real giant. And, you know,
and
I'm sure
how
if you could have kept
him. Do you find somebody who can do that kind of menial job and take great pride in it? I mean, you could have all kinds of people who could, you know, who were pretty bright and could do lots of other jobs. Would they have taken great pride in being a janitor? Probably not.
Probably not. Probably not. Probably not. And here it is, years later, you remember Billy.
Oh, I
do. You might not remember the names of their employees.
No, I don't. I remember very few employees there, but I sure remember Billy, because I made a difference.
Wow. Well, everybody, we're going to stop there for the principles, and we'll pick up next time with principle on principle 56, and that will be there's a method for hiring people. There are two parts to this. There's the first part and the second part. That'll be principle number 56. There is a method to hiring people. We'll pick that up. Professor, we've got about 2 minutes left. Did you? I don't know if you can get into anything concerning the other book, Finding a Career for Life, in that short amount of time, but you can take a crack at it if you like.
Okay, basically it's a book that will puts together all of the information that people should know for picking a career. I wrote it because a lot of my students would come in, and many of them were older, and I heard over and over and over again that I have a degree in something or other, And I went to college for 4 years. I got this degree, and then I found out that nobody's hiring people with that kind of a degree. And I thought, boy, that's sad. And I had just a week or so, a couple of weeks ago, I met a young person who has a bachelor's and is three-quarters of the way through a master's degree in psychology. And she said she got her bachelor's degree, thought she'd go out and get a job as a psychologist, found out there wasn't any, so she's getting the master's. And I said, I hate like hell to tell you this, but when you get your master's degree, you're going to find the same thing. And so she said, God, why wouldn't somebody tell me? Are you the only one who knows that? And I said, no. Everybody in the psychology department in your college knows that, but they aren't going to tell you because they're afraid you won't go there and take psychology courses, and therefore they won't have a job. I think that's what it is. But so this book goes through 660 plus different jobs in different ways. So it asks, what's the fastest growing job? What's the most secure? What job do people have the greatest pride in? What city to go to? And on. If you have only a high school education, what are you qualified for? How about for a 2-year college, a 4-year college, a master's, PhD, whatever? What is open to you? What's the best paying job? What is a petroleum engineer? And you can expect if you go to 4 years and you pay your money and get your education, you can expect about $180,000 a year. If you go 4 years and get a psych degree, maybe you can make $40,000 a year, cost the same. So you may have a loan $50,000 for your psych degree and $50,000 for your petroleum engineer degree, and the petroleum engineers you paid off in 3 or 4 months and go on, and the other one you never paid off. So it tells you all those stuff so that you can make an intelligent decision. It just galls me that hundreds of thousands of young people are making decisions based on misinformation. If they read this book, they will, and it's a short book. It's only 80 pages. When they get through, you will know, be able to pick what you want. I don't have any problem in somebody getting a degree in psychology. If that's what you want to do, wonderful, because it makes you happy. But don't expect it to make you rich, because it won't. And I'm picking on psychology just because that's a fairly popular degree. And virtually everybody who takes that and gets it, the only ones who will get jobs are those who are teaching. And you about have to have a PhD in order to teach it. So
that goes back to one of the principles book. Well, that speaks to one of the principles in this book that we've been discussing today, Entrepreneurial Success. One of the principles is all decisions should be data-driven.
Right.
And so, you know, keeping that in mind when reading the other book, okay, that's a principle that ties right in with the other book in theory. So, Professor, I want to thank you for another great show, taking time out of your day to, you know, share and teach us the principles in your great book, Entrepreneurial Success. And everybody, I encourage you to get the book, okay? I mean, I know there are people that tune in and listen, but you really have to get the book to really appreciate when you're hearing professors speak, okay, because the book gives several examples that you might not hear necessarily during our conversation. So don't just think that I'll just tune in and I'll listen to the show. Get the book, okay, because you might need a principle, because they're principles for business and life, okay? So a principle you might need on the spot, and you're like, okay, I can go to the book and I can get that principle, but it might not be every other Tuesday, it might be a Thursday or Friday, and you don't have a professor in your immediate proximity that you can ask him a question. But if you have the book, then It's like Professor Geiger's always there. Okay, so definitely get the book. And Professor, how can they get it?
At Amazon. And if you go there, go to just go to the book department and type in entrepreneurial success, 105 business principles. Make sure you put the 105. The reason for that is there's a whole bunch of entrepreneurial success books. Mine is 105 business principles. The other way, and you can get that one and finding a career for life there too, or you could go to theroadtothetop.com. And get both of them. The only difference is they cost the same. I sign the ones that I sell.
Well, Professor, again, thank you. Everybody, remember, Professor comes on every other Tuesday. He'll be back Tuesday after next, and we'll be picking up again with, we're going to be talking about how to hire the right people. I mean, my God. I mean, that's part of it right there, right? I mean, you start a business,
yep.
You want to make sure that you're hiring the right people. So you definitely want to make sure you're with us Tuesday after next, okay? If you're listening online, just follow the show and you'll be notified every time Professor comes on, okay? Professor, thank you again so much. You've given us a little more time. Appreciate it. And I'll be in touch and we'll continue the discussion.
Good show. Talk to you. Bye-bye.
All right. Talk to you later. Everybody, that is Professor Joseph T. Geiger, author of the book, Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top, and also author of Finding a Career for Life. You know, this life thing is really, really, really interesting. So when making decisions, you want to have as much data as you can to help you make a decision. And even with all of the data in the world, things come up. I mean, you can have the best laid plans, right, and something come up. But you would rather at least have the best laid plans and have something come up than to be in a situation where you're not successful just because you didn't have the correct data, okay? You want to make sure that as best as you can, that you stack the odds in your favor, okay? So that when you encounter situations in life, you have as much information as you possibly can get to deal with that situation. And even then, things happen. But you definitely want to make sure that you did your part. You did your due diligence, okay? You prepared as best you could to be able to meet situations that you can see coming and even unforeseen situations. That's why, for example, they have insurance, right? It could be a beautiful sunny day and people actually pay to have insurance because why? They may live in a flood zone, right? They don't know when the flood is coming. They don't know when the hurricane is coming. They don't know when the earthquake is coming. And just because the sun is shining today, there's nothing like insurance, right? And you feel safe when you have it, right? So because it lets you know that you're prepared for something in the event something happens. So when starting a business, there are a million things that could happen. Okay, you just want to make sure that of those things that could possibly happen, that you tried to prepare yourself for them. They say information is power. Well, it's powerful if you use it, but it's not powerful to you if you don't get it. So get the book, okay? It's called Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. Professor Joseph T. Geiger is my special guest. He'll be back in 2 weeks, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in. We tell you about the archives. We got an archive section that is awesome, okay? If you're into spirituality, we've got shows in there that you would totally enjoy. We've got shows with, oh, man, everybody, okay? Everybody. All right, so scroll down the archives. Check out the shows. I think that you'll be pleased. We got shows on holistic health. People that have cured themselves of cancer, okay, are my special guests. They're in the archives. Dr. Ted Watkins, Dr. Ruby Lathan, King Coy Dunstan, the spirituality shows with Shechem Shechem, Dr. Raoul Nefa Amen, Dr. Orwa Hehi Medaran Comet, Hexham Suheru, Shechem Meab Neter, and the list goes on. Shechem Sa'antakuna Nebu, okay, and the list goes on and on and on. So scroll down the archives, you'll see shows that really pique your interest, I'm sure. So spread the word. If you like this information, spread the word. Tell somebody else about the show. It's called Health, Wealth, and Divine, also known as Jawanza for Life. Who's Jawanza? That's me. I'm the one who, in giving, receives more. Thank you for your time. Who are you? Peace.